This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Eric Asadourian, senior researcher at World Watch Institute and project director for State of the World 2010. Eric Asadourian is here today to tell us about the 2010 State of the World report titled Transforming Cultures, From Consumerism to Sustainability. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you very much, Diane.
Would you like to begin by telling us about the World Watch Institute and your yearly State of the World reports?
I'd love to. World Watch Institute has been working to teach issues of sustainability for the past 30 years and trying to provide a vision for what a sustainable world would look like. And State of the World is our annual report to communicate the newest facts and newest ideas with our world audience.
What led World Watch Institute to choose the need for cultural change in regard to consumerism as the focus of the 2010 State of the World report?
That's a great question. And actually, in State of the World 2004, we tackled consumption for the first time as our first themed issue. And we mostly treated it as an economic issue. How do we move our economic system away from overconsumption? And I participated in that one as well. And since then, I've been looking at ways to move us as a culture away from consumerism and found a new frame this past year and pushed for the book to focus on this. In essence, we often don't talk about culture because culture is invisible. Culture shapes what is natural for us as individuals. We don't think twice about eating our food with a fork, even though other cultures eat with their hands or chopsticks. We don't think twice about eating beef or chicken, even though other cultures see that as taboo and eating bugs as natural. There's so many things that whatever the culture around us tells us is normal or natural, we take for granted. And unfortunately, today, high consumption lifestyles are taught to us as natural, as normal, as good. And so I proposed this topic in order to talk about how do we change that cultural reality intentionally? How do we transform cultures so that sustainability is as natural tomorrow as living a high consumption lifestyle is today?
Would you give us a sense of the increase in consumption that has taken place worldwide over the past few decades?
I would be happy to, or maybe sad to is probably more accurate. In 2006, which is the most recent year available, we as a world spent $30.5 trillion on household consumption. That's six times the amount spent in 1960. And even taking into account population growth, it's still three times the amount. What that translates to in material usage is visualize 112 Empire State buildings. That is the number of materials we extract from the earth every day as a world. And that translates to 88 kilograms, more than a person's body weight in America, worth of stuff, worth of materials that are used to support our lifestyle. And that, of course, on a finite planet, is utterly unsustainable.
What are the implications of our consumption for our own well-being?
That is at the heart of the question. In earlier forms, we talked more about the health impacts, the stress of high consumption lifestyles. But the first chapter this year really talks about the ecological impacts, because if we don't solve those, no matter how good our life quality is today, there is a wall that we're approaching that will reduce all the gains. So the implications are, of course, directly felt day to day. 1.6 billion people worldwide. That's roughly a quarter of the world that are overweight or obese and are literally suffering from shorter lifespans and more chronic diseases because of consumption patterns. And it's not that they're weak-willed people, but that the culture stimulates an unhealthy diet. But there's the ecological impacts, too. One of the main goals of this report was to rebroaden the discussion in the environmental community away from just talking about climate change, which in my mind is simply a symptom of consumerism, just like obesity is a symptom of consumerism. If a culture that stimulates high consumption lifestyles is, of course, going to mean bad impact on people, but also the planet. We're disrupting nitrogen cycles, the carbon cycle, and all of these that will eventually cause major declines in our ability to thrive as a species.
Well, you've been alluding to this, but what do you see as the key forces that make consumption seem natural and encourage people to continue overconsuming?
The book is divided into six key sections, and those mirror the six societal institutions that are central to shaping culture and shaping cultural norms. And so they play a role both in the problem and the solution. What shapes our culture? What makes living like we live natural? And it's these six institutions, I would argue: the media, business, government, education, traditions, and social movements. Right? And depending on the culture, of course, this mix of institutions, some play larger roles than others. But I mean, in our culture, the media is a good example where they are shaping the reality that we see. And we spend, on average now, about 4 hours in front of the television. And we absorb a significant amount of our fantasies, our desires, through advertising, through programming, of how we want to live. And so when that is encouraging and reinforcing high consumption lifestyles or consumerism, that is a bad thing. But media has increasingly been shown to be able to play a really positive role in encouraging sustainable lifestyles. One quick example, in a slightly different context, there have been family planning organizations that have developed soap operas in developing countries to teach family planning and reinforce different reproductive norms. So encouraging smaller families, encouraging using condoms and birth control and being safe with their sexual practices. And that has not only changed people's minds, you know, doing surveys and realizing that this is working, but it's also had a direct impact on reproductive rates. So there's a clear benefit of thinking intentionally about the role of media. When you have product placements stimulating the use of bottled water, people are going to drink more bottled water. So if we can find ways to use the media in the opposite way, to, for example, celebrate drinking from the tap or having smaller homes or smaller families, all these things can be reinforced and made natural, made to seem natural.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Eric Asadorian, Senior Researcher at World Watch Institute and Project Director for the World Watch 2010 State of the World Report, titled Transforming Cultures from Consumerism to Sustainability. And you are tuned to the Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you also go into a bit of detail about how the other sectors of our society promote consumerism?
Sure, I would love to. Business, I think, would be the most obvious, both through advertising, but particularly just in reinforcing high consumption lifestyles. And this is not just a modern phenomenon. One of the fascinating things I learned over my research this past year was that consumerism had its roots about 200 years ago. And this was in part through the shifts of social values and disruptions in society, moving people away from rural communities and into the cities during the Industrial Revolution. More and more people were becoming workers in machine-like jobs, so that no longer could they define themselves through their jobs, but they started more and more being open to defining themselves through their consumption patterns. And that started to shift things. And entrepreneurs at the time started to realize that there was a real power there. For example, Hosea Wedgwood, who made pottery, he started intentionally using market research and demographic research to figure out how to sell more pottery to the same clients that had just bought something that would have a lifespan of several more years, just by stimulating the fact that this was no longer fashionable. So even 200 years ago, clever entrepreneurs started to figure out how to encourage what's called obsolescence, make people feel that their product that they just bought, even though it's perfectly fine, is no longer good enough. And of course, in recent years, that's been stimulated much more quickly, so that, well, let's give the example of reading a book. No longer is a book even enough, but we now need an electronic book, the Kindle, which then immediately after just a year or so, and people paying $300, came out with a new version. So there's an encouraging of constantly getting new gadgets and moving away from older cell phones to the iPhone to whatever's next. So business is a primary driver of consumerism. But then there's the media, as I mentioned, there's government and education, which are two of the other I really detail in the opening chapter of the report. You know, and that's not always intentional, but consumerism has become so fundamental, so at the heart of our cultures, that certain things are reinforced. In education, not only is it okay that the norms allow for businesses and advertisers to be involved with school education, whether in the form of Coca-Cola in the vending machines or programs like Channel 4, which is a TV news program that is actually, it's a 12-minute news program with 2 minutes of advertising plus many other hidden product placements, but that's sold to schools as a informative news channel, and the kids are subjected to watching it, but yet it's, for the most part, a vehicle for marketing. So those kind of things have transformed the educational system.
Would you highlight the cultural assumptions we need to change to shift away from overconsumption to more sustainable behavior?
I would be happy to. There are many cultural assumptions that will have to shift over time. First and foremost, this idea of perpetual growth and seeing that as a good thing. On a finite planet, that's just not possible. The idea that we are somehow separate from nature, even though we are completely dependent on it, that has to shift. We have to recognize that without a functioning and healthy Earth system, we cannot thrive as a species. Those two alone are important. And those fundamentals, if those are starting to shift, I think cultural values can be shifted as well. In essence, we have to no longer define ourselves as consumers, but as stewards that will start helping to restore the planet. And that's easy to say, much, much harder to do. But I can see that happening, you know, over time. No longer do I define myself through my consumption. And in fact, I'm always trying to reduce my consumption as much as possible. And there are more and more books coming out on how do you live within a 2-ton carbon footprint. And people are leaving jobs that are no longer satisfying or that they see as part of the problem and pursuing new green businesses as entrepreneurs or joining corporations that have sustainability at the center of them or, you know, joining the nonprofit sector. And new ideas are cropping up altogether. For example, one of the most interesting things that I've been following is the idea of shifting rituals to being sustainable. For example, the Green Burial Council is working to question the current norms around the ritual of the funeral and of how we celebrate death or mourn death. Right now, and I unfortunately had to go through this and wasn't ready for it. So, you know, when I helped to bury my father in 2005, I went through the funeral industry and saw it firsthand and how dehumanizing it is to the families and to the loved ones. But, you know, you go through and you pump your loved one's remains filled with toxic chemicals that are hurting the funeral home directors and the embalmers, that are hurting the environment, then burying them in a casket in a vault that literally sells for thousands and thousands of dollars, and then you're burying them underneath a pesticide-laden field, a cemetery. And so basically you're taking a natural part of the life cycle and totally disrupting it and shifting it so that you're separating those remains from nature instead of helping it to do the full cycle and go back into nature. And so there's a real opportunity to shift our values, shift our understanding of our role, and to make a totally toxic and unsustainable ritual practice that we have right now that is a huge burden on people's as families. You know, $10,000 is the average funeral. There's an opportunity to shift that into a beautiful new norm. And groups like the Green Burial Council are working actively to do that. So it becomes natural not to bury your loved ones in a big expensive casket after filling them with toxic chemicals, but burying them in a shroud in a natural cemetery where that cemetery over time is transformed into a restored park, right? You take a marginal piece of land and you start planting trees on it and making it into a new reserve, a natural reserve, which is funded in a part by the funeral, by the cemetery. So that is a wonderful example in my mind of how cultures change, how cultures can be changed through the hard work of, in a sense, cultural pioneers.
For another ritual, we have weddings. Would you like to comment just briefly on weddings and maybe also on decisions you made for your own wedding that were more sustainable?
I would. I actually got married in 2008, and that I had much more preparation for and was very happy with how my wife and I were married. We actually did something very different, and I've been looking to find this elsewhere, but we had what one friend joked as a progressive wedding, like the old custom of progressive dinners where you would go from one house to the next for the appetizer here and then dinner and then the dessert. Our friends were mostly either in the Atlanta, Connecticut, or D.C. area, where we're both from and where we now live. And so instead of having one big centralized wedding, which would have forced many people to fly, which is a major cost of most weddings, both financially and ecologically, we had three small parties, and because they were much smaller, it was much more affordable because we could have them in homes or in smaller spaces. But we had three small parties where we could, you know, actually spend more time with our family and our friends, and of course we had a vegetarian fare as a way to encourage people to live lower on the food chain. I actually used my father's ring so that I didn't have to harvest any new gold and was able to take my grandmother's old ring as well for my wife. So it was as sustainable as we could think through, and hopefully was a way to celebrate both our love and do so in a way that was celebrating the earth as well.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Eric Asadourian, Senior Researcher at World Watch Institute and Project Director for the World Watch 2010 State of the World Report, titled Transforming Cultures, From Consumerism to Sustainability. In your view, what best triggers cultural transformation? How do we best cultivate cultures of sustainability?
That is the $1 billion question, not even a million. I wish I had the perfect answer, and I don't. And hopefully every year that I wrestle with this, my knowledge will grow. But two things that I wanted to really communicate in the book is that there is no silver bullet. It's not one institution that will drive change. We can't create an ecological tax, and that will suddenly create a better price for carbon, and everything will be fine, just like we can't better regulate businesses only. We're going to need all six institutions intentionally mobilized to really see the changes that we need. So we need to work on changing traditions just as much as we need to utilize government to really drive forward change. So that's one of the main points. The other main point is that it's going to take cultural pioneers. This is a word I used in the report for two reasons. Because for me, a pioneer symbolizes frontiersmen moving forward, and that's part of the American mythology. But also a pioneer species is an important species in ecosystems terms. When a system is disrupted, these are the first things that blossom again. And honestly, consumerism will eventually fail under its own weight. There's just no way that consumerism can keep going on our finite planet, especially as more and more people around the world want to enter into this cultural reality. So it will take people right now, while we have the stability, to start cultivating a new culture of sustainability and through any institution that they're engaged with already or want to engage with. So if they're a policymaker, they can work on creating a carbon tax. If they're in the media, they can work on embedding product placements for sustainable living into programs or work on social marketing efforts. If they're an educator, they can work to create a green curriculum for their classroom or work on changing the diet in the lunchroom so that it actually teaches a sustainable dietary norm. Wherever you're engaged already, there's ways to become a cultural pioneer. And that is essential that we do that now so that, the foundations, the seeds are sown early so that it can help set up a new culture of sustainability.
Would you mention some of the cultural pioneers whose work has been most helpful?
Well, again, it's hard to single out anyone because you have to go through those six institutions. And I mentioned already in the traditions that work, the Green Burial Council is really working on transforming those rituals. In the realm of business, the ideas of social enterprises is a powerful and a transformative one. Right now, our culture reinforces the idea that the main reason for business is to maximize profit. But that is a totally cultural assumption, right? It could just as easily be that business's reason for existence is to improve society. And there are entrepreneurs now, social entrepreneurs, that are pursuing that specifically. Whether you're talking about the well-known Muhammad Yunus, who is transforming the financial industry both in Bangladesh and now across the world, whether you're talking about clever restaurant entrepreneurs like in Thailand, where a restaurant called Cabbages and Condoms has really taken the world by storm. This restaurant, along with its funny name, the goal of it is to be profitable, of course, and mobilize that profit to actually provide community groups that are addressing different family planning and health programs, but also through the restaurant itself, educate people that are coming there for dinner on how to practice safe sex, right? So instead of getting mints at the end of your evening after your meal, they have bowls of condoms and they have condom art, and they're basically really encouraging you to think about safe sex and normalize it so that safe sex isn't really seen as something you have to, you know, talk around, but it's actually made clear that this is natural.
What most stands in the way of adopting a sustainable lifestyle that isn't based on overconsumption?
Well, one thing that we often talk about in the environmental community is we overfocus on individual choices. We say, okay, change your light bulbs and get a hybrid car, and those will be some of the key first steps. And then we hope that that will empower people to get politically charged and get engaged. But that's going from the bottom up rather than making transformative shifts to a cultural system. There's one article in the book that talks about something called choice editing. And I've seen this on the very small scale just starting a few weeks ago here in D.C. When a government, for example, edits choices, right? So that could be a tax or banning a certain technology, like there are now incandescent light bulb bans across the world, that suddenly changes how people live, both consciously but also, even more importantly, unconsciously. So an acquaintance of mine who doesn't really have any care about sustainability issues or even pays attention to it suddenly started bringing a reusable bag with her wherever she went because of a 5-cent tax here in D.C. that started on January 1st when you get a bag in a store. It's a very small tax. You know, it's simply nominal. It's not really a major cost to the consumer, but now that they're suddenly being made aware that, wow, I have to pay for this, the behaviors are changing at almost an unconscious level. And not because it's an ecological thing, but just little barriers put in people's ways change how people live. And that's one way that cultures change. And that's one of the key roles for government is, you know, redesigning urban centers, and suddenly if everyone can live easily walking and biking, and at the same time it's very difficult for them to drive a car, the culture around transportation will change dramatically. It will no longer be seen as valuable to own a car. It won't even be seen as cool. You know, the coolest people will be those that live car free. And that's that mental shift that will have to come. So I think that's the key kind of step, is that we have to really work at the macro level and mobilize individuals not to change their individual consumption patterns, but to become leading cultural pioneers driving that shift.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
If I could say just one thing, it's being open to the idea that culture is really the driving force that shapes what you see as natural and normal, and considering that and seeing how you can take an active role in shaping that process of what becomes natural in a way that actually will allow us to to thrive as a people, as a species, long into the future. So thinking about how you can engage and drive forward a culture of sustainability.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Eric.
Yeah, it was my pleasure.
You have just been listening to Eric Asadourian, Senior Researcher at World Watch Institute and Project Director for the World Watch 2010 State of the World Report, titled Transforming Cultures, From Consumerism to Sustainability. For more information, check on the web at www.transformingcultures.org. Again, that's transformingcultures.org. The Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters Sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.